I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Imagine that you keep changing the passwords for your bank accounts and credit cards, but hackers come back again and again to loot your cash and savings. Not only that, but they steal your identity and buy themselves a luxury trip to Paris. Well, maybe something like that did happen to you. Hi, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk. My guest this week is Michael Mestrovich, the former director of the CIA's Technical Services Office, as well as Principal Deputy Chief Information Officer for the U.S. Department of State. Mestrovich, all too genial for a man with such grave responsibilities, left the government a few years ago as a member of the Senior Intelligence Service. Today, he's on the private side of the cyber war world as Chief Information Security Officer for Rubrik, a firm that helps corporations and other entities prepare for and deal with hostile cyber intrusions like ransomware attacks, essentially terrorist-style shakedowns for immense amounts of money. With no relenting in such attacks, witness the recent hits on Las Vegas casinos and hotel complexes, and a China-based breach of senior U.S. officials' emails, including those of Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, I figured it was time to check in on the dark world of the cyber warriors. Mike Mestrovich, welcome to Spy Talk. What are the chances that right now, as we're talking, there's a major cyber intrusion into a major government agency or corporate entity like a bank or a casino like recently happened? What's the chance of that happening right now?
Well, I think the chances are probably pretty high. I'm sure that we'll hear about it several, you know, weeks or potentially months down the road.
Do you know of any going on right now?
I only know of things that have been reported in the news. As you referenced, both Caesars and MGM reported cyber incursions over the course of the last week or so. So those are probably the most the ones that are most recently in the news.
Mm-hmm. And also this summer, the Commerce Department, the State Department were hacked allegedly by the Chinese. We don't know if that was a government entity or not. And I'm going to come back to that question of the connection between Chinese government and Chinese criminals.
Sure.
So, but for now, why is it that these major institutions, not to mention the government, keep getting hacked? What's going on there?
Well, it's a bit of a complicated question. We could probably spend days talking about it. I think in brief summary, a couple factors have transpired over the years. First and foremost, I think you have to take into account the rise, the advent of cryptocurrencies. And that means that from a cyber perspective, particularly with regards to ransomware, cyber criminal elements can get paid, and they can get paid in ways that are very difficult to follow the money trail. And so five cyber criminals have been able to monetize cyber crime, and then the payment method is, you know, cryptocurrencies, and that's made it very effective and very profitable. Cyber criminals, as we said, have understood that the data theft, either taking data from an organization and selling it to perpetuate, you know, financial or identity theft, and the monetization of that, or simply denying an organization access to its data so that it can't run its business operations, it's losing money on a daily basis, They've utilized both of those methods in order to make money, and they've done it very, very effectively. We used to see very, very long dwell times for cyber incidences. I think now those dwell times have diminished because cyber actors
dwell
are perpetrating
times.
Their crimes, arguably on a Friday once the IT staff has kind of gone home. They perpetrate it over the weekend. People come in on a Monday morning, but they find that they've been hacked. They have a ransom note. They expect payment, and payment can be issued relatively quickly. And then, you know, they move on and go to the next. So they've just really monetized this, and it's a cyclical process. And so that's the cyber crime piece. To your point as to why does this keep happening? Well, digitization, automation, information technology, it's pervasive in everything that we do anymore. And so the target audience is just ripe with IT systems that are expansive, that oftentimes don't get patched, but also with human beings. I mean, let's face it, most of these cyber attacks are perpetrated because people are able to utilize social engineering tactics to compromise credentials, which is the first way in. And then from there, it's just a matter of kind of running the table on the organization.
In the movies, when there's a ransom paid, blackmail paid, the cops mark the bills somehow, and that way the money can be traced. So are you saying that there's no way to track digital payments, shakedown payments to these criminals? Is that it?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's no way, and I think the FBI actually has a history of being able to track down some of these payments, and you know, they from time to time they've been able to recover some of these ransomware payments. Certainly, I'm not an expert in the forensics of financial crime, but I do understand that it's very difficult. Oftentimes, mm-hmm. you know, with the financial transactions, the financial transactions go through multiple different entities before they end up with the end recipient. So I believe it's a much more difficult forensics trail to follow. And obviously, you know, the FBI just has some limited resources. So the amount of cybercrime being perpetrated is probably arguably more than the Bureau can certainly handle in any one given moment.
Is it true to say that the reason these hackers find it so easy to get into our systems is because of human carelessness or mistakes, because someone clicks on a link sent to them by email and they're fooled into thinking it's real. And so no matter what defenses that MGM and so on, or let's say the State Department, the Commerce Department, Gina Raimondo, the Commerce Secretary just went off to, even though all these defenses are erected, people still can be fooled into clicking on an email link that opens up the doors to the hackers. Is that the situation we're in?
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. And I think, you know, I did a presentation a few months back, and I referenced an IDC report, and the IDC report showed that in 2022, effectively a third of all cyber attacks were enabled through some type of email compromise, and then fully a half of all those attacks were enabled through some way of credential stealing. So yeah, it's at the end of the day, the cyber defensive team needs to be 100% accurate every single day, and that not only accounts for the systems that they're trying to protect, but that accounts for the user behavior for every single user that uses those IT systems in an organization. Mm-hmm. It's a really tall order.
So there's no way really to prevent these continuing attacks, because people, I'm not going to say people are stupid. I clicked on one last summer, and I'm really vigilant about this stuff. But let me go to the government again, government intrusions. How do you, the CIA, you know, and insider threats are also a big problem. The CIA suffered an insider threat in which a lot of its tools were stolen, according to numerous news reports. How do you repair, you know, your house has been wrecked by a burglar. How do you repair that? How did you repair that at CIA?
Well, I can't go into the specifics of the CIA incident. I can certainly talk generically about, you know, the insider threat piece, which, you know, certainly it's credible. More so than the insider threat, though, I think the piece that you touched on initially was this. Cybercrime and cyber attacks are really enabled by getting the right types of credentials. And so whether you're a nefarious insider or whether you're a cyber actor and you just have access to elevated privileges, that's where the cyber crime perpetrates itself. And it's organizations that have elevated credentials, privileges of system administrators or network administrators. And then when you have those privileges, you're allowed to go anywhere and do anything. That's where the problem occurs. And you've seen in the news recently, it's been talked about extensively, this zero trust architecture. And really what that talks about is just because you have a credential does not mean that you're not going to be challenged for access to resources repetitively, continuously. And I think enabling those types of controls helps to limit what those cyber actors, whether they're nefarious insiders or external cyber criminal gangs, it limits what they're able to do because they're bounded in where they can go and what they can do. Almost like watertight compartments on ships. Like if one compartment is compromised, the rest of the ship isn't compromised because the damage is contained.
Well, let's talk about that incident with the Air Force, National Guard Air Force guardsmen on Cape Cod who got access to all the top secret Pentagon documents, particularly related to Ukraine and more damaging. What's a lesson learned from that?
Well, again, it gets back to need to know and making sure that the individuals and the credentials they present are used to give them access to information that they readily should have access to.
And he had access. Why did he have access to all this ultra sensitive material?
Yeah, I can't go into the specifics. I will say that, the intelligence community has for a long time wrestled with need to know and need to share. And obviously, information is only good if you have parties that can work with that information, manipulate it, that information, make sense of that information, make decisions on that information. So there's a need to share. There's a need to share that information responsibly and understand and control who is reviewing it, who is accessing that data. I think in this particular place, clearly that's where this broke down.
Yeah, he was an airman first class. I mean, what is he doing having access to this? It seems to me, I am not a techie, obviously. It seems to me, if he's a clerk, let's say, and passing along stuff, he need not have access to the meat of the reports. Just, am I on the right track here?
No, you're spot on. And again, this has been the ongoing conversation. There are people that obviously need to know the intimate details and then make sense of those and do something with it. And those people should have access. And then there potentially is a whole group of people that are just transient participants in it. And they really don't have a need to know. And you can do one of two things, right? You can either, try to restrict access so that they don't have access to the meat of the material. And secondarily, you can also audit who is accessing that material. And when you see things like access decisions that look like they're abnormal from potentially an airman sitting in a National Guard base, that should trigger somebody saying, hey, wait a minute, this isn't normal. Why is this person doing this?
Well, according to news reports, he was enabled by his commanders. I mean, something was really wrong on Cape Cod. Let me ask you about an old topic here, the Chinese infiltration of the OMB files. That's the personnel office, you might say, for the entire federal government. Have you seen any effect where Chinese intelligence has been using that material to reach out to officials who have secrets or lower ranking people who have secrets, making approaches to them using that personal information?
Jeff, it's a good question. I think there's a lot of questions as to what the Chinese did with that material. I would argue that the Chinese for a long period of time, just based on the size of their intelligence service and the apparatus, have really been just vacuuming up vast amounts of data. Potentially they will accumulate that data and over time make inferences, do link analysis, try to put the pieces together for future operations. I don't know that any action immediately was taken based on that information. What I can tell you is we saw kind of in the MGM case, the Chinese are all over social media, and they understand and are looking for people that, you know, they may be able to manipulate into getting them information about certain topics that are of interest to them. So they're all over social media. They are putting together the pieces of who works where, what affiliations those individuals have, what types of access to information those people may have. And based on that, then they run targeted mm-hmm. campaigns against those individuals.
But do you know of reporting, of reports or, you know, gossip you've heard, rumors you've heard, or whether it's that some official, some mid-level official reported to FBI or CIA or whomever saying, you know, this Chinese businessman just contacted me out of the blue, or contacted my wife or children or whatever. And I don't know this guy. He makes a business proposal to me. I suspect this is a Chinese espionage ploy. Have you heard reports like that coming in?
I mean, I don't have firsthand knowledge of that, but certainly, you know, anecdotally, I have to believe that happens quite often. And certainly, you know, the FBI from a counterintelligence perspective certainly gets involved in those types of activities.
Mm-hmm. And not to stay on this forever, but you believe it could happen. But do you know of it happening, that people are saying, my God, I've been contacted out of the blue by someone who I think is Chinese intelligence?
I mean, I only know about it through the press reports when it comes out after the case was shared.
Have you found political groups? You know, we've seen, you know, we have the rise of this extremism, right-wing extremism in this country and actually globally. We've seen it in Europe as well. Do you know if right-wing extremist groups have begun to engage in cyber war?
I don't know. I have not seen any reporting or any instances where right wing extremist groups are engaged in cybercrime or cyber espionage. No, I haven't seen that. What I would say, kind of related to this topic, is, again, going back to influence campaigns and impacts on social media, people do need to be aware that, you know, foreign intelligence services of non-friendly nation states are involved in running influence campaigns against social media, and so they are picking out targets. They are poisoning social media with fake narratives, and they are trying to create conflict within our own civil society, trying to diminish the authority and the integrity of institutions that we should trust to have a functioning society. That's not all generated solely by right-wing extremist groups. A lot of that information, disinformation, is fostered by foreign intelligence services who are trying to use that to create a wedge.
Sure, we saw that. Have you seen evidence that hackers, foreign hackers, whether they're criminals or, you know, we know that they're government hackers of our enemies, whether they've used stolen material to proliferate it on social media? I mean, we saw that with the WikiLeaks leaks back in 2015-16. What about ongoing?
Well, I think ongoing, I think it was maybe maybe a month ago, where Facebook reported that they took down a number of different purportedly Chinese intelligence service activities that were propagating false narratives across Facebook. And so this continues to go on. We see it all the time. You know, Microsoft announces the fact that they take down a number of different, or highlighted a number of different forward intelligence influence campaigns across social media sites as well. So this is going to continuously perpetuate itself. I mean, I think a lot of times the social networking sites that we participate in oftentimes are, you know, they're kind of echo chambers. And so we don't seek out alternative viewpoints. We don't try to engage with people from different perspectives. We're very happy consuming information that meets our own worldview and mindset. And foreign intelligence services know this, and they can exploit that. That's a weakness. It's a known weakness, and that's what they try to exploit.
Now, we know about most of the hacks, I assume, maybe all of them, that have been perpetuated here by foreign actors. or criminals and or criminals or both, because of the nature of our open society. Can I assume that we or other our allies have gotten into the pants of the Russians and the Chinese, their entities, their banks, their financial networks, political networks, and so on, but they're not going to publicize it because they're closed societies?
I think it's fair to say that we, along with many of our allied counterparts, have very capable cybersecurity capabilities, and certainly, we're going to be doing our part to make sure that we're keeping up with our adversaries. I think that you have seen from time to time reports coming out of Russia, most notably since the Ukraine war has been ongoing, of certain sites and certain institutions that have been degraded by cyber activity. So every now and again, you do see that from time to time. But you're right, they are closed society. They don't think you're going to see that as publicized. They're not going to make that as well known even within their own amongst their own population.
This is sort of in the area of Mad Magazine with spy versus spy. I mean, we do it to each other. We're inside their infrastructure, their financial institutions, and it's tit for tat. It doesn't matter who started it. This is the ongoing silent war, so to speak. It's going on every day. We're carousing around inside the. I think Americans would be happy to know that we're barging into the MSS, the Chinese Intelligence Service, or the People's Liberation Army, and we're reading some general's email today. I think Americans would applaud that, don't you?
I think Americans would be very happy to know exactly that we have a very capable cyber capability, and that we're using it to protect our national interests and. Where possible, degrade the capabilities of our adversaries.
Now, you ran CIA Technical Services. I want to ask you more about that job. But from your perch as the Chief of Technical Services at CIA, are you looking down as a sort of like if you walk through the cyber offices of CIA or anywhere else for that matter, it's sort of a video game war going on between the Chinese, Americans, the Russians, North Koreans, and the Iranians, and they're going bang, bang, zoom, have sound effects in their computers and so on, knocking out bad guys. Is that what it looks like to you?
I wouldn't say no. I don't think the visual perspective that you have highlighted, it's not there. It's it's a lot more subdued. It's people behind keyboards. Doing what they do best. It's not as glamorous or as flashy as the media would portray in movies or TV shows.
Well, in the Vault 7 case, the stealth of CIA cyber tools by an insider, the description of that, and I'm thinking one article in particular in the New Yorker, in which it sounded like a bunch of kids having a great time, engaging in warfare with their adversaries. And it was it's a different kind of office than you might find elsewhere at CIA, right? These are kids for the most part, young people. Playing a game of wits with the Chinese, Russians, etc.
Well, I think if you look at the lineage of cyber professionals, there's a great deal of art to this, much more so than kind of engineering. And so it's in many ways, shape, or forms, it's a collaborative effort. It's effort by trial and error. Certainly, there are some known good principles and techniques, but oftentimes it's a little bit of a bespoke game of trial and error, and that does create a great sense of camaraderie, and that creates a great sense of competitiveness as well amongst individual teammates. And so it's kind of the environment.
It helps a lot, by the way, if a CIA officer recruits an agent, an official of a foreign government, and gets them to, put something in the computer to infiltrate the network for us. So it's not just cyber, it's a spy inside a foreign intelligence. That's a big leg up, isn't it?
Certainly, having assets on the ground is absolutely a great capability. So, we that certainly helps the cause.
Let's educate people on what the CIA's technical service office does. I mean, were you the guy in charge of bugs?
No, a little bit more mundane than that. We were one of the offices that ran a large segment of the IT organization for the agency. So you can, think of all the things that allow the agency to function on a day-to-day basis.
For example?
Just for example, people, logging into their computers every single day, being able to, interact with parties around the intelligence community, being able to make phone calls, computer systems that, operate, being able to review imagery, intelligence products, those types of things.
So sort of to trail off toward the end here, where is this going? Is this more of the same for the foreseeable future? Major government offices and banks and casinos, et cetera, even school systems hacked. There's not any way to really prevent that ever.
Well, again, I would argue if we can, through a number of different mechanisms, take the financial incentive out of cybercrime, then yeah, we'll see cybercrime diminish. We'll see the hacks diminish. Let's separate out the hacks against governmental organizations, because that's more about understanding policy, understanding direction, understanding negotiations, and that type of thing. But if you take the hacks against school systems, corporations, if it can be demonetized, then yeah, it would stop. So the question becomes, how do you demonetize it? I don't perpetuate that you have to have perfect security. That's not the answer. The answer is that your security has to be good enough so that it's harder and more costly for the cyber criminal to get in and get any usable data out than the attack itself is actually even worth. And if you can change that dynamic, then yeah, I think that we can see cybercrime diminish. Unfortunately, we just haven't gotten to the point where we've been able to successfully change that dynamic.
Let me ask you about that. The metaphor is often used is, well, we got to lock our doors. It's just like in your neighborhood, keep your home doors locked, your garage doors locked. That seems to be an oversimplification, as I'm inferring from what you just said. You said you got to raise the cost to an intruder. How do you raise the cost to an intruder?
Let's use your analogy, right? I mean, like if you have a simple deadbolt on your door, but you've got, the crown jewels that are worth tens of millions of dollars inside your house just sitting on your dining room table, I'm pretty sure the criminals are just going to use a battering ram to bust down the door and come in and grab the jewel. Like you need higher protections because you have more valuable things inside.
I'd enjoy that challenge.
and that's the same, I think, for corporate entities to understand, is that they have data that is of value to the criminals, and they actually need to make it more difficult for those criminals to get in. So we talked about this very early on, which is, once I have a credential, that doesn't mean that I should be able to go everywhere. But putting in place those bulwarks, putting in place those extra checks internally, that's oftentimes cumbersome and oftentimes costly. But I would argue the cost diminishes the capabilities of the cyber criminal, the cyber actor. And so that potentially will deter them from trying to attack your organization, because they know that attacking your organization has diminishing returns. It's too hard. They don't get enough out of it.
Wow, boy, that's complicated. So you're now in the private sector with a company called Rubrik. Are you sort of a fireman on call when there's an intrusion? What do you do?
So I'm the chief information security officer for Rubrik. And so I have three roles really internally. First is to oversee the governance, compliance, and reporting organization. So, we have a number of different certifications, and making sure that we maintain those and that those are applicable in our product. The second piece is securing our product. So obviously we're a software company. And so I have a team of people that works to ensure that the software that we develop is free of defects, cybersecurity holes, bugs, that the architecture is sound, that it incorporates zero trust principles, so on and so forth. So that's the second piece. And the third piece is just ensuring that the IT systems that we use to run and operate the business, that those are secure, that we have effective countermeasures for cyber attacks against those, that we have a cyber operations security center that's looking for signs of intrusion, that we can respond to those types of things. So that's kind of the multifaceted role that I have at the company.
How many times, Mike, have you just, do you have a dent on your forehead from slapping it with stupidity on the part of users' ends, you know, clicking on bad links and so on that opens the door to an intruder? Do you keep seeing, I mean, how many times do you slap your forehead a week?
there's a number of times when I ask myself, why would anybody think that that was a good idea to do that?
Are you talking about clicking on a suspicious link now?
It amazes me sometimes that people do believe that they actually did get $100 gift card from Home Depot for just like, you know, no reason other than just Home Depot wants to give you $100 gift card.
Mm-hmm.
That's generally surprising. But realistically, I have to be pragmatic. You know, from a cybersecurity perspective, we see a lot of bad behavior all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we're used to it. But, you know, oftentimes, you know, people don't see that. So they don't understand the threats. And so a large part of our job is just helping our employees understand what the threats are and why somebody would actually target them. Like they just when they understand why they may be a target and what the threats are, they're generally great. They get it and they're able to modify their behavior. So a large part of this is really just educating people as to why they would be a target and why they should be vigilant.
Mm-hmm. But you're never going to get into a zero intrusion era because people are going to be stupid still.
There will always invariably be that one person. That's the case.
And that's the way it is. So, Mike, thanks for spending this time with us. You've got a very busy schedule, as someone might infer from this conversation. So thanks for taking the time out to talk to us. It's very valuable. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. It's been a great conversation.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive at the MSW Network or on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, please check out the Spy Talk news site on Substack, where I and our deeply experienced contributing writers offer a steady diet of intelligence scoops and original analyses. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast, like all the others, was smoothly produced by Kanai at MSW Media with expert editing from Molly Hockey. Thank you, guys. Oh, and by the way, that music you've been hearing, that's the score for Black Hat, the 2015 cyber action thriller composed by the prolific British composer and conductor Harry Gregson-Williams. So that's it. Thanks for listening. I'm Jeff Stein.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their
bubble.
Own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jolene Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar, available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.